Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And, for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger.
Hello. We recorded this episode of Table Talk a little earlier in the year, before the current situation with COVID-19 had arisen. So if you hear conversation about restaurants and dinner parties with no mention of social distancing or isolation, that's why. We hope you enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, The Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And we're delighted today to be joined by John Williams, who's been the executive chef of The Ritz since 2004. In 2008, he was awarded an MBE for services to hospitality, and he's cooked for all sorts of impressive and interesting dignitaries, including Margaret Thatcher, who he cooked the 70th birthday banquet for, and Her Majesty the Queen, who he cooked for on her 70th and 80th birthdays. John, thank you very much for joining us. We're actually here in the kitchens of the Ritz, so you can probably hear the background noise of the Ritz kitchen.
The hammering of the butcher's block.
It's just sound effects. We'll start where we always start, at the beginning. You were born in South Shields in Tyne and Wear. Can you tell us about your earliest memories of food?
Well, there's certainly a time with my mother. I had twins that were just slightly younger than me, 2 years younger than me. And apparently I was a very, very greedy child. And I don't know if you know or whether you're allowed to use the word, but rusks, Farley's rusks. Mm. Well, apparently I used to wake up in a mood when I was a kid, and I was obviously 2-year-old, 3-year-old. And my mother started giving the twins rusks, but they used to put them in the milk. They used to melt them in the milk, but I used to steal them. I used to hide underneath the bed with the rusks, eating the rusks. So I hope that's early enough.
That's pretty early. That's pretty good.
I was a bit of a greedy young boy.
And your father was a fisherman. What, yeah. Should we assume there was a lot of fish in your diet at that stage or
masses.
Not?
Masses. That was his career. That was what he did all his life. Very, very hard life. And he used to love a drink. He used to drink a little bit too much. But he used to come home. And you could always tell when my dad was coming home. You've heard the story about the seagulls following the boat. Well, my dad used to have 2 bags of his fisherman's fry. And of course, he used to be quite drunk and he used to be, you know, level him up, the 2 sides of bits of fish. And he used to have the seagulls following him. No. But, it would be things like plaice, smoked cod, kippers, all of which I still love today. A little bit of cod. But the real treat would be prawns. Now, he was never allowed the prawn tails. All of the prawn tails were sent off to actually be made and frozen into scampi tails. So we only got the claws. And my dad used to say to me, okay, grab hold of it, the claw. And he says, bite into it. I used to crunch into it, break it. And he said, right, just suck it like a lollipop now. And I used to suck them. And the sweetness of that meat from the prawn, what we now call Dublin Bay prawn or langoustine, the sweetness from that meat is the most divine seafood there is. And not a lot of restaurants ever actually serve the claw. But you can imagine, because of my background, I make my cooks meticulously, with tweezers, pull the claw meat out, which is, honestly, it's very, very laborious. But it's worth every cent to me because I just love the taste and the sweetness of the claw. And I've been doing it for quite a while, and I've noticed recently a lot more restaurants seem to be actually using this now. But it's a beautiful taste.
And with your dad at sea, your mum ran the home.
Yeah.
And you had 5 siblings?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
And she was a good cook.
Well, you know, I think she was. But the reality of it was, she was a home cook. She was nothing exceptional. When she used to bake, she used to make lots of what I call plate pies. And she used to line the plate with pastry, and it would be savoury. But when she made a pie day, it was a pie day. You know, she'd make 2 of each, and it would be ham and egg. There would be a mince pie, that kind of thing, mince and onion. And then for fruit, it would always just be apple. apple and blackberry or something like that. And very, very simple, but with, you know, the apple and blackberry with custard, I just get wound up now. So I don't want to say that she was the bee's knees. She was a mum's cook, and I love my mum's food. It was as simple as that. And I was actually chosen not so much to cook, but to help her. I don't know why. She used to make me go to the shops with her. I used to carry the bags for my mum and what have you. The first memory I have of actually cooking and helping her was, it was in the springtime. It was a shoulder of lamb. We never had legs of lamb because it was too expensive. And my mum used to slow cook the shoulder of lamb, which I still adore today. These principles still come into kitchens like this because they did things correctly. That's, you know, we might change a recipe, but the process of slow, long cooking, which is the only way to cook lamb, a shoulder anyway. So she had this shoulder of lamb in, and I distinctly remember that. And she says, okay, take those potatoes. At that time, didn't have a clue, but it was Jersey Royals. The treat for doing them was 3 or 4 large Jersey Royals, just with melted butter over the top, a little bit of salt, and I had that before lunch. And I had to make the mint sauce, and she had this special cup. It was a chip cup, that's what it was. And she used to say, right, chop the mint. I said, chop the mint. Put it in the cup, put a little bit of vinegar, put a little bit of sugar, put a little bit of water. Yeah, Ma. And she used to put, I said, do you want it in a pan? She said, no, just put it in the oven. She used to put everything in the oven. But it came out, the mint sauce was, you know, perfectly good.
And is it true that your reward for helping with the shopping was a bag of tripe?
Yeah.
Tell us about the tripe.
There's a couple of things I'll tell you first. She used to take me shopping, and one particular summer's day, I remember going into the fruit and veg shop. The smells were absolutely amazing. There were very few things that we were allowed, but as a treat, it was, right, we're going to have some strawberries, but it was the old-fashioned punnets of strawberries. They were quite large. And in those fruit shops, there weren't refrigeration. So everything would come from farms or delivery merchants, and they would come and store in the shop. They had to move it. But the aromas in there were absolutely fantastic. And I remember one particular day, my mum coming back. There was a electronics factory we were coming past. She said, John, I'm sweating you. She says, get us one of those strawberries, will you? And she took a strawberry and she gave me a strawberry. She had a straw, and we were sucking on this straw, and the juice was coming down me like this. But the scent of that strawberry was so amazing. Over the years, I would say in the last 30 years, what people have tried to do is make you have strawberries all the time. And I will never touch a strawberry unless it's June or July, just because I know it's not going to have that. It's amazing how something so young can actually put that in your brain. Now, on the way back, I know it's a long way round how I've got there. We used to have to go to the pork butchers and the tripe shop. It was called the tripe shop. And in this shop, this is God's honest truth, they only sold pig's trotters, tripe, and a couple of other little bits of pork. And my mum used to buy some honeycomb tripe for my dad. He loved tripe and onions. And black pudding. That was, he used to have that together. And it always had to be what we call sauté potatoes with onions, or Lyonnaise onions, what we call it now, potato Lyonnaise. And that's what he used to have. That would be once the time that he was home, coming from sea. And for a little treat, my mum used to give me a little bag of tripe. But it was blanched, and what they used to do was just put a little bit of vinegar on there and a little bit of pepper. Of course, that was in a what you know now as a chip cone bag. And I really did adore it. I still do like it. I know a lot of people
don't. Can
you
get it anywhere in London? Is it?
Yeah, you can still get. You can still buy tripe.
Yeah.
You know, you can still buy it on the market, but it's not freely available.
Yeah.
You know, but it's still around.
And we normally ask about school dinners, but you didn't stay around for school dinners, did you?
No, that's another funny one. I remember, you know, my mum was working very close by, and there were six of us, and they all went to school dinners, and I rebelled. There were certain days I used to run away from the smell of school dinners. Fish. And I said, "Mum, I can't eat it. I can't smell it. I can't take it. Tapioca." I used to reach. Honestly, just the smell. And she says, "Okay, you come home." And she used to come from work just to give me something to eat. The funny thing was, I was a football fanatic. And then we used to do a lot of training then. So I was in and out of the house 15 minutes and I was running back to school. But it was so much better because Mum was giving us the food that I wanted. I think I was just, I had a certain taste. And I still don't like bad taste.
And did you know back then that you wanted to work in the world of food?
I was probably about 12 when I actually thought I want to be a chef. There's a couple of reasons. At the time, there was a lot of recipe cards coming out with some of the foodstuffs, and I think it was Spice Company and I was fascinated by spice. And there was a man called Graeme Kerr, the Galloping Gourmet, who was very, very famous on TV, probably one of the first real TV chefs. I mean, he wasn't the greatest cook, but he was a great character. And he used to travel all over the world to the greatest restaurants. And he would go and see the chef. The chef would create his speciality or the dish he wanted to serve to him. And Graeme Kerr would then take it back to the studio, reproduce it. Not quite the same, I might add. But he used to give it a go. And he had a beautiful long table. And then he would actually finish off the dish, put three plates out. He always had the most amazing wine. He used to always play up how much the wine was and how special it was. And he used to put that down. And then he used to run to the front row, pick out the two most beautiful ladies there were. He'd grab one, put to the right-hand side, one to the left, place the food down, pour the wine, and then he would sit down, all smiles, knife and fork in hand, tuck into this dish that he was actually eating, and then drink the wine. Oh, my God! And I say, "God, he's made it." And I'd say, "I want some of that." And I'm still looking. But it was so good.
So did your culinary career begin at... Because you studied at South Shields College. Yeah. Was it there or at the Percy Arms that you began?
That was simultaneous.
Okay, tell us about that.
I was writing for a job when I was about 15 and I got offered an apprenticeship, and it was in the Percy Arms Hotel.
That's in Otterburn, yes. In the northeast.
Yeah. It was about 40 miles away from where I lived. With that, I actually enrolled to the college. I'd already started in the college, in actual fact. And I worked 5 days a week. I did five split shifts plus three, I don't know if it was two or three breakfasts that I had to do. And then on my day off, I used to have to go to college. And for the benefit of that, I got paid £9 a week. And the thing was, I couldn't even be taxed because it was under the threshold of taxation. So, you know, you were working really hard in those days. The general manager's wife was a very, very elegant French lady. And, you know, people take a shine to you in life. She took a shine to me and she says, one of the things she would do to educate me, she says, "You're going across the road to the hotel tonight. I booked your dinner. You're going with my au pair. You're going to have dinner tonight." I mean, I'd never taken anybody to dinner in my life. 40 years later, I did go back there. But I'll tell you about that later. And her father was a director of Le Doyen restaurant. Now, Le Doyen restaurant is still a 3-star Michelin restaurant in Paris. And she would bring all kinds of different things into the hotel, coming back from France. Things I just didn't have a clue what they were. The one thing I do remember... foie gras, the first time I ever seen foie gras. It was in a tin that she brought it back, but it was the first time that, you know, it just wasn't in my vocabulary. And as she was doing this, what she didn't know was she was setting me on fire. Now, this goes back to the Graham Kerr thing of where he was going to some of the greatest restaurants in the world. If I wanted to cook with those special kinds of ingredients, such as foie gras, whatever, it had to be coming out of the Northeast and going somewhere else. And my first approach was to actually get to London. And I applied for a job in the Royal Garden, and they offered me a job straight away, and I just came down.
How old were you then?
I wasn't even 17. I was still 16 and a half.
And what were your first impressions of London at that point? What was the food like?
Oh, my first impressions was a couple of things. I come from the Northeast. I spoke very different. I felt a little bit lost. I felt out of my comfort zone because of my accent. Nobody bothered me about it, but I felt that. But there was always someone to actually sort of say, you know, we're there with you. So I've been very fortunate in life as far as having someone there all the time. So although I was very young, there were a lot of good people that I was around, if that makes sense. And I stayed in the Royal Garden for a year, and I was actually enjoying it, but I was homesick. And when I say homesick, I was homesick. And after a year, I went back. I went back to the Northeast. And I said, my mum, I'm coming home, I'm homesick. She says, hi, you know, we'll get sorted. I went and started in a place, doesn't matter where, it was the best place in the Northeast at the time. The first day I went in, the smell was horrible. And I mean the worst. I'm talking about putrid dairy, stale food, you know, where food is not at its freshest and it's hanging around in the air. Chefs with very, very long hair and dirty hats. And it really did have a big impression on me. And I only stayed three shifts. And I said, I've made the biggest mistake of my life. And do you know what I did? I got home, said to my mom, I'm going to make a telephone call. I telephoned my boss that I had just left in the Royal Garden. And I said, you know, chef, I've made a mistake. He said, I'll see you next Monday. And so it was a week's holiday. I was away. I came straight back, and I knew then that it was just get your head down, start working. And I was very fortunate, and I was always being promoted. And in those days, I really felt that it was quite easy in kitchens to get on, in the sense, if you had good common sense, you did the right things, you tried to make something a little bit better, you had a little bit of drive in you, it was superseding a lot of things that were happening. All I wanted to do was make it better. I wanted food to be nice. I wanted food to look lovely. You know, some people didn't mind that at that time, but I wanted that. And, you know, every now and then I'd say, oh, well, I'm leaving. I would have another job. And he'd give me a big rise and say, no, you're going to stay. And he kept on doing this for about 7 years. And I'll never forget, and one day he says, it's time for you to leave now. I said, what have I done? He says, oh, it's not what you haven't done. He says, the good news is you're going to leave. I says, oh, yeah, why? He says, I've bought a restaurant. You're going to run it.
So which restaurant was that?
It was called The Crocodile in Kensington Church Street.
That was where you ultimately became chef director?
Yes.
Is that right?
Oh, from the start.
Oh, from the start you were chef director of it.
I was only 25, 26. I was 25. I wasn't even that. He was obviously overseeing it. His wife was there, but I ran the operation, as it were. It started off and we built it, and it was honestly the hardest work of my life.
Why?
I used to go to the market, 4 o'clock in the morning, myself and another chef. We had seen this, the great chefs of France, going to markets, collecting their own food, choosing their own food, bringing it back and cooking it. It was a fashion that was coming to specialist restaurants in 1980. You know, it's talking a good time back. And we used to actually go and buy fruit and veg, the fish market, the meat market, and then we'd just top up with suppliers, as it were, but most of our buying was done on this weekly basis. But at 4 o'clock in the morning till 12 o'clock at night, and then work 6 days a week. My half day was a Saturday, and I used to get in 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, until 12 o'clock at night. And then Sunday, I used to sleep all day, getting ready for the Monday again. And I did that for a good, it was just under 2 years. And for several different reasons, I then made my mind up that that is not what I was going to do. I was going to go into hotels. And I was very fortunate that this same person that I went to the market with, he brought his owner in for lunch. And she was absolutely fascinated about the food. And she says, "Why are you cooking this food in this place?" She says, "It doesn't fit." She says, "The food's very, very elegant, and it's the..." She says, "But the restaurant's not quite there." Meaning the decor, you know, it just was a brand new restaurant. It didn't have a great deal of money. And I had met a chef called Mario Leshnik on several occasions. And she says, "Oh, he's looking for a chef." I said, "Okay." So I actually rang him up. Oh, what I didn't tell you, I used to also work in a great little restaurant. My little time in restaurants was very important because I worked in a place called Mac Cuisine. Now, in the 80s, very early 80s through to 90s, it was probably one of the finest, if not the finest restaurant in London, along with the Gavroche. They were the first two-star restaurants in London. And it was in Walton Street. And I used to go and work there 4 mornings a week for nothing, just to learn different techniques. And it put me in great stead for, you know, because I was actually learning at different angles, you know, at the restaurant style, in banqueting style, in hotel style. And I thought, right, I need to really step up. And I telephoned Mario in Claridge's. He had offered me a job the year before as a sous chef, but this job was for a premier sous chef. So it was his number two. And I went and seen him, and he offered me the job. And he says, "You know, pop in and see me tomorrow." I says, "Well, I'm at work. I'll not be coming dressed." Because then you're automatically always dressed with a suit and a tie. For an interview, you'd never do anything less. He said, "Oh, can you pop in tomorrow?" I said, "Do I need to get dressed? I don't normally dress up for work." And he said, no, you don't need to dress up anything." So I was very casual, open neck shirt, a jacket, but very, very casual. And he said, "Oh, can you just pop upstairs?" He says, "Mr. Jones, the managing director, would like to sit." I went, "Oh my God, I'm not dressed. I'm not this." I went up there, sat down, and there must have been 6 or 7 people, all in morning suits and everything, firing questions to me left, right. I went, "What?" Anyway, I answered the questions. Just, you know, they weren't difficult questions. They're just saying, "How would you deal with that? How would you?" And I answered them. I obviously answered them well enough, because by the time I got downstairs to the chef, he says, "Oh, you did very well." He said, "Mr. Jones says, yeah, definitely, you can join us anytime." But I think there was also a thing. Ron Jones had opened the Royal Garden. And you know that little affiliation? And he knew my boss and chef before. So, of course, I think that helped me a little bit. And I was offered the job and then went straight into Claridge's as the executive sous chef, which was very young age to do such a job.
And what are the sort of defining characteristics of working in a hotel restaurant compared to, you know, the other restaurants that you'd been working in before?
From a kitchen side, it's very, very important. When you work in a hotel environment, you have the customers, the guests in the hotel. They're paying a lot of money to stay in the hotel. They're generally much more expensive. They're much more, I'm not going to say more demanding, but because of people staying in hotels, they'll just say, "I want that." In a hotel kitchen, you will generally just say, "That's what I've got to serve." So the customer, you know, is the lead every time. And it was always this thing, you never said no. That was another thing, which is not always the best policy. When you want to cook fantastic food or fresh food, if you pull me back, I'll explain that later on, because it is quite important. Because what you end up doing is following the customer when you're in a hotel. Yes, you can cook some of your specialities, but the hotel will have in its infrastructure a style. So you have to follow that style. Whereas in a restaurant, if I'm the chef of the restaurant, it is my dishes. It is everything that I do and my strengths of what I want to serve to my guests. See how it's different? Mm. So you're working from a strength point of view in an individual high street restaurant. No matter how great that is, you're working from your strength. And the customer is coming for your speciality. In a hotel, they're coming to say, I want. Does that make sense?
And you came to the Ritz in 2004. Is that right?
Yeah.
How has the food changed here since you began? If at all, maybe it's exactly the same.
No. It changed a lot. I had an association with the Ritz for a long time. The very first time, which was quite a particular thing as well, I came from Green Park, walked along underneath the arches, and there was a presentation window. And in that window, there was a crockery, and it was saying, you can dine off this crockery for an extra £25. I think it was something like that. But that was the equivalent of a meal. That's how much that £25 was. The ownership was Trafalgar House, who owned ships and things. And they had a shipwreck that they had taken this crockery up from, and I don't know how many years it was before, and they were offering to sell it from this very specific shipwrecked china. You know, when you just look at something and you're agaze and you're thinking all kinds of things. And I thought, one day, and this was when I was about 17, 18. I said, one day I think I would like to work there. Not knowing, of course, I would actually end up being here as chef. Now, going back to the food, what I can tell you is when I came here, I believe it was a little bit too eclectic. I think what you do is you have to respect the building, respect its history. You have to understand the whole ambience and what the story is of the Ritz. When you sink into that, you actually bring forward and analyze the kind of food and why the Ritz is the Ritz. You then can actually move forward. But it's going back in time to actually analyze and then think of Ritz. What happened? Why did Ritz open the hotel with this style? And what was his intention? What was good about Ritz? All of these things are very important. One of the things, of course, is Escoffier was his chef. And Escoffier made Ritz a very famous man. There's no more famous hotelier, is there? The man that was front of house that wanted to give a great time to everyone and celebrate and, you know, make a beautiful party, allow the ladies to enjoy. They brought ladies into restaurants. In actual fact, it was the Savoy where they did it first and foremost, but straight away in here, where they would encourage single ladies to come into the restaurant, which was never done before. If you notice in the restaurant and everything, there's a lot of pink. That pink was just specifically done so that the pink glow for the ladies, because they always felt if you looked after the ladies, the gentlemen would come. It's a symbol, but it works. It's true, isn't it? And all of these things. And when you go back to what real good food is, one of the things that I picked up on, it was getting a little bit eclectic. The one thing the Ritz is not is eclectic in its food and its style. And it's very much Marie Antoinette, you know, in the sense of the whole French style coming to England. That's the best way I can describe it. It's the two together that makes that specific style. And the whole food has to be of a specific nature because of this grand restaurant. And so many people are food writers. I used to see, the dining room is magnificent. It's fantastic. It's this, you know. It's probably the finest dining room in Europe, if not in all of the world. And that was said many a time. But does the food match the restaurant? And I used to hear this. This was before I came. And I used to always question, why did they say this? Why did they say this? When I arrived, the one thing that I had said to myself, I've got to grasp that and set the stage of what we're going to serve that does marry with the style of the room. All it was, the room was so powerful in its style and decor, you have to follow it. You have to keep in theme. So the silver aspect, if you take away the silver, and they had taken away some of the silver, they had put in some different kinds of china, which were totally irrelevant in its style. And what it does is it weakens your whole table and atmosphere and, you know. So I sort of looked at this and I said, you just can't work like that. The first time I ever came into the kitchen with the general manager, on top of those hot plates there, it wasn't that particular one. It was another one. And they had these cast iron pots. And they were made by Staub, which is a brilliant cooking pan company. And they were serving food in them. And the whole style, can you imagine, it's that color, black, just like that. And
it's the base of the microphone,
we say. And they would serve this food in it. If you go into that room and you serve it into a black pot with a little bit of brass trim on it, it's very rustic. Rustic and the Ritz don't match at all. And that was the whole thing that I was actually really finding very quickly. The thing in my head, it was always to go back into the classic era, i.e. look at Escoffier. I was a follower of Escoffier. I'm also a disciple of Escoffier anyway.
Which is an official thing.
Yeah,
that's actually a club, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm very much part of that. So it was very important to me anyway. And it was about how do we actually take these kinds of dishes with the style and pomp that they had, but bring them into our time. So it became very much relevant for the modern day diner. And that, I use that word all the time. We are classic, but we have to remain relevant for the modern day diner. The moment you're not relevant, what happens? You're closed, you're dead. So the style has to remain for Ritz. It must not be rustic. I've killed people for being rustic. Not really, but that is one thing. I remember somebody, he'll not be named, but a young chef came to me and he said, Chef, I've got this dish to serve. I think it was the first time I ever went mad. I said, what do you not get? How can you have a rustic pasta dish in the Ritz? He never gave me another dish.
And what do you think of the kind of classic Ritz dishes that sort of bring together the kind of British cuisine with that Escoffier element?
The whole thing is how you interpret those dishes and how you modernise them to give them their relevance for today. It's as simple as that. And you can do that with any dish with the correct kind of thought and process of going forward. The foundation of what my cooking is exactly that. And that's the way I've always been. The reason I like to use classic cooking is because classic ingredients go together. That's why they become classic. I'm not the kind of person, you know, you're forever in restaurants in modern day life where somebody will come, they've got some blood-sucking orange that's mixed with a magnolia plant. And I'll say, hang on, why have you got that? They'll say, well, it hasn't been used. But do you know why it hasn't been used? And that's my answer, you know, but I'm a great believer if you have the right kinds of ingredients that marry well together, that's where you start to build good cooking along with seasonality because the product is at its best at that particular time. It's then a matter of actually very simply bringing those things together and understanding how to cook. Now, when I say understanding how to cook, I'm not talking about a recipe. I'm saying, do you understand how to braise? Do you understand how to bake, how to poach? When you do that, the recipe can then be added on. And of course, it's then about the richness, the amount of fat content, because we're still rich. The food is still rich, but it's so much lighter than it was 50 years ago, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. But that's how we have to move forward. We can still have some of the ingredients in, but maybe less of it. And we actually make different kinds of emulsions to have the same effect, but with the same ingredients. And then it becomes much more palatable for the modern day diner. But of course, the presentation, the whole ambience and style in the restaurant has to be maintained. And what we've done in so many of the dishes, we have waiters which are still in morning suits. They're in tails. You can't just be a plate carrier for that. They have to work. And of course, we've simplified a lot of the tableside service, but you still have tableside service. And what's happened? Everybody's got rid of tableside service. Everybody's getting rid of old school style. So what happens? We've become unique. And providing we are doing it with good style and good presence, surely it's actually something, as long as it stays unique, we'll have customers that want to come here. But it's about being relevant for the modern day diner. Because if you're not, we've had it.
And John, you've cooked for all sorts of fascinating people. Obviously, Margaret Thatcher was living here for her final years, and you've cooked for Her Majesty the Queen. How do you go about constructing a menu for that sort of person?
I've got to tell you a lovely story. That picture behind you there is special to me. But Lady Thatcher is quite a lovely little story, so you're going to have to bear with me while I tell you the whole thing. I wasn't working here at the time. It was in Claridge's, in natural fact, and she had her 70th birthday. But when I tell you some of the biggest people or the most important people in this country were there, the Queen was there, everybody was there. I think it was about 100 people. And she came to meet me with Lady Elizabeth Anson, who was the party planner. And she had a husband there, Dennis. As I've sat down, I thought, John, do you realise how important? And I just sort of went, very nervous. Yeah. And she was at the height of her power as well. And she's still, you know, a very, very, very strong lady. And I thought, wow. And she looked at me, and I think she knew I was a little bit nervous. I said, now, chef, let me tell you what I eat, and it'll give you an opportunity to have a little think what we're going to have. So I said, oh, yeah. And she says, in the morning, I don't really eat breakfast. She said, have a cup of black coffee. She said, 10:30, I might have a cup of tea. I might have a biscuit. She said, lunchtime, if I'm out at a party or anything or any kind of business trip, she said, I eat whatever is on the menu. I went, oh, very good. She says, in the afternoon, I sometimes have a piece of cake and a cup of tea. And I'm going, God. She says, in the evening, she says, if we're out on official business, I eat whatever is on the menu. She said, but do you know what, chef? If we're not eating out and I'm here, in 10, not here, but if I'm in 10 Downing Street with Dennis, do you know what I have? I said, I haven't got a clue. She says, anything that I can get from Marks and Spencer that goes in that machine and it goes, ping, ready. Now, chef, you're in charge what we're going to have to eat. And I just went, shoo. Okay, let's go.
Top-terminus.
You know, I said, this is easier than... We ended up, because of certain reasons, she had a chicken dish, which I distinctly remember to this day. It was a special chicken dish with a champagne cream sauce, mixed wild mushrooms, specifically morels and asparagus. For dessert, she had apple and bramble. It was an apple kind of bavois type of thing, which it was in vogue at that kind of thing, with some fresh apple balls caramelized and some poached brambles. blackberries. So they were sitting, and we had a hell of a job to try and drain them to make sure that they didn't run into the lovely cream sauce. But she adored it. Now, how do I know that she adored it so much? That's the reason I said it gets a long story. And it all went according to plan. We were over the moon. We distinctly remember that the Queen was always a person that would be very specific about time. And she stayed 45 minutes later than she was normally meant to. So we just thought, well, it's because the party's gone so well. Anyway, it's not so many years ago. It's probably about 5 years ago. No, it's more than that. It was right at the end of her life. She was actually living here. And she used to be on table one. And I don't know who the person she had lunch with, but she would have lunch there all the time that I've ever worked here. And, you know, it was once or twice a month that she would be on that table one for lunch. This particular day was at the end of her life. That's all I can remember at the time. And I don't know if you've heard of Peter Alice, the golf commentator, very famous BBC. And I did some work and charity jobs with Peter Alice. But on this day, he came, instead of a round with Alice, because he had a program called A Round with Alice, it was a lunch with Alice for a charity job. And Peter was upstairs, so I went to see Peter. And he's a fantastic man. He really is a special kind of man. And he said, "John, have you seen who's over there?" And I said, "Yes, Peter." He said, "Do you go and see her?" I said, "No." I said, "She's private." So I told him the story of that function. Well, he got up. He says, "You go and see her now." He says, "If you don't, I'm going over there and I'm going to make sure you do." And I went, "Oh, my God." I thought, it's the worst thing I could have done was to tell him this story. He says, "You've got to go and see her after that, just to see if she even remembers you." I said, "No, she won't." I said, "Don't, you know." Off I went. And this is the God's honest truth. I approached the table. I said, "Lady Thatcher," I said, "excuse me." I said, "I just want to see everything is okay with lunch." And I said, "I just want to say, you know, for your 70th birthday when you were in Clarence, I was the chef." She said, "Oh, my dear man." I said, "I don't expect you to remember me or anything." She says, "Remember?" She says, "Of course I remember that chicken with the champagne sauce and the mushrooms." I went, and she said, "No, don't forget about the dessert neither." And I went, "Oh, my God." Well, I just turned around the stairs. I flew down the stairs and came and told everybody the whole story. And it's the best thing that could have ever happened. And if anybody asked me for my best moment, I think it was that.
And do you have a sweet tooth?
Who told you that?
Just a guess.
Oh, I'm terrible. I am. The one thing that I worry about is the amount of sweet things that I love. And there's no dessert would ever get on the menu without me eating several before.
What's your favourite dessert on the Ritz menu?
At the moment, it's a difficult one. I love souffle. Grand Marnier souffle is probably, well, without doubt, it's my favourite souffle. And it must never be with ice cream. Another little classic thing. In the olden days, you would never serve a souffle grand marnier with ice cream. I know lots of restaurants, they do lots of ice creams. It was with whipped creme chantilly. And believe me, if I give you a souffle, chocolate souffle or grand marnier, with lightly whipped vanilla cream or ice cream, and you taste it, I know out of 100 people, 99.9% will say vanilla creme chantilly. But as a dessert, my real favourite at the moment is actually it's chocolate and banana dessert. It's a little bit to do with the techniques. It's very light in banana. It's not pieces of banana. It's actually a mousse type of thing. But it's done in a beautiful brick and sprayed with chocolate. So it has a light, crisp coating and a lovely textured coating. But it's also got this beautiful fondant, which is through the center. And then we have this wonderful cage of chocolate that the pastry chef does. When I say the structure alone, he needs a medal for that. In the center, he has this wonderful paste, very, very crisp and very delicately brittle, and that it just, you know, it goes at the touch of the tooth. And inside there, you have a wonderful ice cream parfait that goes through it. So it's like a little cigar. And that goes through the chocolate. Just amazing. And of course, it's finished with a little bit of melted fudge. So it's all the things that I really adore. The types of chocolate that are in there as well is just amazing. I think chocolate is addictive.
John, thank you so much for joining us and for inviting us into the Ritz to interview you today.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.
Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger